This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I think one of the very exciting things about the book, Capitalism in the 21st Century, is this enormous data contribution it has made. It is built upon a 250-year period of observation over a lot of countries about income and wealth, and so it's really changed the game in this field by putting these enormous materials for discussion. And anything that happens like that is not just a single person. I mean, Tamar wrote the book, but he's very clear and very generous in the. And if you read it, he describes a considerable length the people that he worked with to develop the database and to make it all happen. And I thought it would be tremendously exciting. There were two things I thought would be fun to do about it. One is to use the book as an opportunity to engage the campus and the community in a conversation on this enormous topic and to do something interdisciplinary. And if you were there this morning and you're coming in the afternoon, you will see we've tried to have interdisciplinary panels, because that's not such an easy thing to do, as Tamar discusses in his book. It's a cross-disciplinary game that we're engaged in here. So we're doing that in the morning and the afternoon, and I thought at lunch, one of the fun things, at some point in this, and we're doing it at lunch today, would be to show that there are other people engaged to get the opinion of thought in the conversation amongst the people who worked with Tamar in developing the whole thing. And he discusses in some detail some of them. This is a sample of who's there, but in the book he talks about Atkinson and other people who really helped do this and who are continuing to do this. And so I thought it would be very interesting for, to understand the nature of the research or what this is, and it's an enterprise for us to understand something about how all that works and so what's happened, that it's taken these different kinds of people to do this. And so that's what the logic of this roundtable is. And so I'm going to introduce all of our speakers to you as a group, and I call them on my notes the Fabulous Four. So let me introduce the Fabulous Four to you, and I'm going to introduce them in the order that they are speaking. And Tamar is going to go last because he gets this whole evening gig today that you can all go hear. But let me start in the order they're going to speak. First, I'm going to pick Art Goldhammer is going to go, and Art Goldhammer is a very important part of this entire enterprise, because Art Goldhammer is the fellow who translated this into from French into English. And Art Goldhammer isn't just a random translator. I don't mean that to be insulting to translators, but Art has a PhD in math, and I'm sure that, and he knows a lot of economics, and there's just no doubt that that is an essential ingredient and his ability to have done such a fantastic job with this. But he also has been translating from, Arthur is one of these people who decided that with his PhD in math and teaching math, it's not what he wanted to do in his life. So he has spent 30 years translating from French into English, leading books in social science and history. So he comes very remarkably well equipped to do that, and he's gotten a lot of awards from France in doing it. He was recently promoted from Chevalier to Officier in one of the awards in France, so that's pretty impressive. So that's Art, and then to Art's left is Jean-Laurent Rosenthal. And Jean-Laurent is currently professor of business economics at Caltech. I first met him when he was at the UCLA economics department. We once ran a conference down here together on corporate governance, as it happens, a topic which came up in the previous session. But he's written lots of things on this thing. You can look it up online. But a very important thing is that he and Gilles Postel-Vinet and Philip Hoffman, I think, also was involved in this, had done a lot of the work with Tamar on the developing the French data and how to construct this over a tremendous, how to understand wealth and income in France over a long period of time. And then there is Emmanuel Saez, and he is maybe more well-known to many of you. He's a professor of economics at Berkeley, and he and Tamar have co-authored quite a lot of important papers. So in the field of economics, he's already famous in this field. Their papers in economics are quite well-known on this topic, and particularly in the field of in developing the American data. And so he is their written work in the field of economics has helped make this work very well-known. And then on my immediate left is Thomas Piketty himself, author of this book. And as Arthur will explain, it's already sold over 1.5 million copies. And an interesting thing about it is, in terms of forecasting, is that no one predicted when they signed up to do this that that was actually going to happen. So that is a really very fascinating thing, and I think that quite clearly he has changed the topic of the field to make the questions of distribution and income central in a way that it had not been in the field of economics for many years. And so he's changed the entire conversation in that field. And so that's my very great pleasure to have all four of these people here. And what they're going to do is they're going to talk. If they have no slides, they're going to stay in their chair. If they have slides, they're going to go to there. And then when that is all done, I will try to open the thing up for guests and questions to all of you in the same way that we did in the previous session, which is to walk to the mics and do it there. So it's my pleasure to start with Arthur.
Okay. How do I turn this? It's on. Thank you, Peter, for that very generous introduction. I'm very glad to be here. It may not be quite dying and going to heaven, as the gentleman suggested this morning, but it is an honor to be here among the makers of this book. When Peter first issued the invitation, he suggested that I talk about the making of capital in the 21st century, and I thought that really that would be taking too much credit for myself. These are the men who made the book. I merely translated it into English. So I suggested that I would talk instead about what I call the Piketty phenomenon. And I want to start by giving you a couple of measures of that phenomenon. One is that over the 37 years I've been translating, I've translated 127 books. And it's not quite true to say that Capital in the 21st Century sold more than all of the other books put together, but it's almost true. Which was quite sobering for a translator to realize. I will give you some other less personal measures of the dimensions of the Piketty phenomenon. The U.S. sales to date are something like, I got these figures from Harvard University Press, or English language sales, I should say. To date, which is a little over 2 years since publication, around 650,000. It's the fastest-selling book in the 120-year history of Harvard University Press and has sold more than any other title published by the press. The global sales are over 1 million. There are editions in more than 30 languages. Thomas, when the book came out, made a book tour of the United States, which included academic lectures, public meetings, a meeting with Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury, and Gene Sperling, Assistant to the President. And in addition to that, more importantly, he appeared on the Colbert Report.
That's real fame.
That's an indication of the rock star treatment he received. And indeed, I'm not exaggerating when I call him a rock star, because Bloomberg Business Week created a parody cover for Business Week that portrayed him as a rock star with all of the captions that usually go with fan magazine covers. He also received a telephone call from Bill Gates. If you were around college campuses, you know that T-shirts and sweatshirts began to appear with the formula R greater than G emblazoned on them. The Harvard University Press softball team adopted R greater than G as the formula on its uniforms. A session of the American Economics Association was devoted to the book. It received laudatory reviews from two Nobel Prize winners, Paul Krugman and Robert Solow, and Thomas appeared with a third Nobel Prize winner, Joe Stiglitz, in New York, along with Krugman. The Financial Times tried to refute the findings of the book, and having failed to do that, they then awarded it the title of Business Book of the Year 2014. And Thomas was offered and refused the French Legion d'Honneur. So how do we explain all this? Well, we can't, or I can't, really. If I could, I would be a wealthy publisher instead of a struggling translator. But I'll mention a few things that might be correlated with this success. Since I'm on a panel with three illustrious economists, we know that correlation is not causation, but it's the best I can do. There will be five parts to my analysis. I'll talk about the anticipations of the book's sales, the political and social context created by the Great Recession of 2008, which may have contributed to the success of the book. Then a brief survey of major reactions to show what nerves were struck in the first readers of the book. And then I'll talk briefly about the academic reception outside economics, which is one feature of the book's success was its disciplinary boundary crossing. And then a word or two about the political response and Piketty's own conception of the relation of capitalism and democracy. So first, on anticipations, I canvassed people at the press. Ian Malcolm, who was the acquiring editor of the book, told me that he expected, rather optimistically, that the book might sell as many as 200,000, but over an extended period of time, 2 years. It sold that many copies in just the first few months. He based that estimate on having published previously the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time is Different, and he thought these would have comparable audiences, which is more a publisher's instinct than an analytic evaluation of the content of the books. By contrast, the head of the press, Bill Sisler, told me that he thought the book might sell 20,000 copies if we were lucky. He expected the book would make some noise, that is, it would get a lot of reviews and some attention in the press, but wouldn't necessarily sell a lot of copies. And then, just to give an indication of the most clueless anticipation of the book, in my own case, I had a choice whether to take royalties or a fee-for-hire contract, and I chose the latter because with most academic books, the percentage that a translator gets make it more advantageous to take fee-for-hire. So I quite miscalculated. So, other factors that might have influenced the judgment of people involved in publishing the book, the author did have a previous track record, particularly because of his work with Emmanuel Saez. This series of papers on income inequality was quite well known in the United States, but within a fairly restricted audience. If you were an academic economist or a careful reader of the New York Times, then you knew about their work, but certainly not millions of potential readers. Another way that publishers evaluate the potential of a foreign book in the American market is to look at the sales in France. That was not possible with Thomas' book because there was some competition to acquire the rights, and the book, the rights were sold before the book appeared in France. When it did come out in France in September, before the spring publication in the United States, it did attract some attention. There is a myth afoot that the book did not do well in France and it only sold after the American reception was reflected back in France. Thomas can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that's entirely correct. It sold quite well for an academic book in France in the tens of thousands in its initial sale. It's true that there was a second wave in France after it came out in the United States, and the French newspapers began to cover the rapturous American reception. But it was a book that stirred considerable interest in France. I arrived for a visit in France in the week that the book came out and was greeted at the airport bookstore by the cover of Le Point, I think it was, which featured a review by a well-known French reviewer who, and the subtitle of the review was Un Marxiste de sous-préfecture, which was a derogatory and insulting evaluation of the book, which did not bode well for its success in the American market, but it did show that the book was at least generating controversy in France, if nothing else. And it also points to another factor that may contribute to the success. On the airplane out here, I was reading Donny Roderick's new book, Economics Rules, about what the economics profession values. For Roderick, it's relatively small-scale models that can be evaluated by the criterion of their applicability to various public issues of the day. And he contrasts this with the kinds of books that used to be written under the rubric political economy in the 19th century. Well, Thomas explicitly describes himself as someone who would like to be considered a political economist and not just an economist. So the fact that he grappled with big questions of the history of capitalism over a long period of time, like such illustrious forebears as Adam Smith and Karl Marx, I think had an appeal for readers outside the academic profession, but may in some ways have complicated his reception inside the profession. That brings me to my second topic, which is the political and social context in which the book was received. So we all know that the Great Recession began in 2008, and in many quarters this made it respectable once again to speak of systemic inequities of capitalism, a subject that had become, in some respects, taboo, at least within economics, for many years. It's less true in sociology and political science, where distributional issues remained on the spectrum, but not so much in economics. So the Great Recession changed all that. There was a widespread reception of unfairness in the political response to the Great Recession. Bailouts seemed to benefit banks and insurance companies, while ordinary people suffered. This spawned the movement known as Occupy Wall Street in 2011. And Occupy Wall Street, as you all know, used the meme of the 1% versus the 99%. That same way of describing inequality was made well known by the series of papers I alluded to by Piketty and Saez. But it would be hard to prove that Occupy Wall Street was actually drawing explicitly on those papers. It was a way of describing inequality that was used by others for a long time over the same period that Piketty and Saez were publishing. So it's not so clear that that was the origin of that meme. Now, the issue of wealth and income inequalities have been raised repeatedly since 1980, particularly by sociologists and political scientists, using the same kinds of measures that Piketty uses: the disparities between different quantiles of distributions, the ratio of CEO to worker pay. And we heard this morning from Valerie that those figures may be somewhat misleading and in need of revision. We'll await further studies on that. But the question remains, why now? Why did all this attention focus on this particular book at this particular moment? Well, one explanation would be that politicians began to take up the theme of inequality. Obama, in the fall of 2013, chose inequality as the issue for the 21st century. He said this would be the crucial political issue going forward. But the response to that speech was rather lukewarm, and subsequently it dropped out of Obama's political rhetoric, so it really did not continue. Other politicians did take it up. Elizabeth Warren made a major speech on inequality. Bill de Blasio ran for mayor of New York what year was it, 2011, using inequality as one of his major themes. And it was not just politicians who took up this theme, but also think tanks such as the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, which had been focusing on wage inequality in particular for many years, but they focused on the middle, the median of the stagnation of the median wage, rather than on the top end, which was really the focus of the Piketty-Saez work. Larry Michel, who's the president of EPI, congratulated Janet Yellen on a speech she made because she acknowledged the grave implications of growing wage inequality. And he quoted the Yellen speech at length, and I'd like to do the same because I think it's interesting. This is Janet Yellen speaking in 2013. It is no secret that the past few decades of widening inequality can be summed up as significant income and wealth gains for those at the very top and stagnant living standards for the majority. I think it is appropriate to ask whether this trend is compatible with values rooted in our nation's history, among them the high value Americans have traditionally placed on equality of opportunity. Yellen's words touch on a deep anxiety about the link between increased inequality and reduced social mobility, with implications for the health of democracy. Now, that perception, I think, is real and widespread, but there's a question about how empirically true it is. It's somewhat ironic that the work of Emmanuel Saez himself, along with Raj Chetty and others, questions whether mobility has actually decreased, while suggesting that the consequences of reduced mobility are exacerbated. So Let me quote from the Chetty Saez et al. Working paper, NBER working paper number 19844. Quote, we find that all of these rank-based measures of intergenerational mobility have not changed significantly over time. For example, the probability that a child reaches the top fifth of the income distribution given parents in the bottom fifth is 8.4% for children born in 1971, compared with 9.0% for those born in 1986. Children born to the highest income families in 1984 were 74.5 percentage points more likely to attend college than those from the lowest income families, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, they stress that the consequences of the birth lottery, as they call it, the parents to whom a child is born, are larger today than in the past. So what they find is not much change in intergenerational social mobility, which in some ways is a paradoxical finding given all this interest on and focus on income inequality. So what can we and then I want to mention one other factor that might have contributed to this, which also came up this morning, and that's the effect of the Citizens United decision. Now, as you heard from Gary Jacobson, the actual effects of that on the American political process and the influence of money on the selection of our leaders may be small, but I think it had a large effect on the perception because it seemed to open the floodgates to, in the minds of a lot of people. So this anxiety about the influence of money on the political process, I think, may be correlated with the success of the book. But this brings me to my third issue and an apparent paradox. We can ask, who are the readers of Capital in the 21st Century? Were they the OWS marchers, the Occupy Wall Street people? Probably not, I think. My hypothesis is that, in fact, most of the readers, at least in the United States, came from what Piketty calls the patrimonial middle class. These are people toward the upper end of the income distribution. If you read the book, you know that what Piketty finds is that we're in a second golden age, but this second golden age differs from the first in that wealth is slightly more widely distributed at the very top of the wealth distribution than it was in the Gilded Age. Well, this patrimonial middle class is not homogeneous. In part, it's made up of people like us, professionals who owe their status to educational achievement, who are believers in meritocracy, who work in professions that are largely insulated from international competition. So the factor of globalization that you heard about this morning are diminished, and who are willing to pay higher taxes in order to achieve a kind of society that pleases them more aesthetically, politically, and socially, a society with greater inequality. And they're concerned not so much about their own distance from people below them in the social hierarchy, but on their lack of influence over the political process as they perceive it, compared with the influence of a certain extremely wealthy people, people referred to in the work of Theda Skocpol and Vanessa Williamson on the rise of the Tea Party as roving billionaires. If you know the Skocpol Williamson work, you know that they attribute the rise of the Tea Party to two phenomena which are related in some respects and independent in other respects. There's a rise of grassroots right-wing populism, but on the other hand, that right-wing populist sentiment has been exploited by what they call roving billionaires who opportunistically focus in on races where right-wing candidates have a chance to win and to influence the policies that are of interest to these extremely wealthy people. So my hypothesis is that the readers of the book are largely members of the patrimonial middle class who have a kind of status anxiety, to use a term popularized in another context by the historian Richard Hofstadter. They're anxious about their own lack of influence in the culture and on the political process. Ironically, in a sense, Thomas Piketty offers a message of hope to the people in this group. He says that we faced a Gilded Age before with extreme inequality, and we were able to overcome it by the political process, by starting a democratic political movement, and he hopes that his work will contribute to such a movement in the future. That's the optimistic side of his message. The pessimistic side is that he shows that this political movement in many countries took exogenous shocks to make to give this movement a purchase on the political process. And these were not minor shocks. They were major shocks like world wars and extreme social displacement caused by the expansion of capitalism into corners of the society where it had not had influence previously. So on the one hand, a message of optimism. On the other hand, a message of pessimism. And now I said I was going to speak about critical reactions, but I think I've already talked too long, so I'll stop here, and we can take that up in the Q&A if you're interested in that aspect.
Thank you, Arthur. Jean-Laurent Rosenthal.
So when we were planning this session, Emmanuel observed that we had not written Capital in the 21st century. So I don't have a whole lot to say about how Thomas put this book together. I can only say that I had the same feeling as Arthur, because when I was asked to read this book for Harvard University Press, my only comment is, Thomas, could you cut 150 pages? It won't sell this long. So our errors are our errors. So what I want to talk about is, a great book is actually a moment for a discipline or disciplines to reassess what they're doing and to take up some new challenges. And for me, I'm an economic historian, so I'm going to talk about the challenges for economic history. So one of the problems that we have to begin with is the most important book in economic history in the last decade was not written by an economic historian, though we're happy to confer all sorts of medals on Thomas and give him that title if he wants it. And actually, Thomas is teaching economic history this fall. He doesn't come from that source. And it's not written with sources that we usually rely upon. What was remarkable about the work that Emmanuel and Thomas did around 2000 is that they were using sources that had been available to people for a really long time and not using systematically. There is a certain part of what they did that is obvious after the fact, and that's important. It also raises critical issues for growth and distribution over the long term, including for where we come from. And one way you can measure where we've been is when I was in graduate school, I remember going to see my advisor and saying, I'm kind of interested in inequality, and he said, that's a political problem. We're worried about economic growth. So when I met Thomas about 15 years ago, it was a chance to go back and try to undo some of that mental damage caused by an advisor. So what we have done is, there's two ways to think about what we've done. We've put together data on wealth in Paris over roughly 200 years, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And the other one you can say is about we spent about a little over $1 million and written three papers. So on a per word, this is one of the most expensive projects you could imagine. But we're promising to actually start accelerating the process as we have the database arrives to completion. And the goal was to assemble a long-run micro data set on wealth. So why do that? The first thing is, this is one of the reasons Thomas' book is called Capital in the 21st Century, is that most inequality is capital income inequality. Because capital, or wealth, is very unevenly distributed. Second, you want a long-run micro data set because wealth accumulation is a generational process. Just walk around San Diego and look at the age of the buildings. They were not all built yesterday, and they're not all getting rebuilt tomorrow. But jobs are changing at the rate of 4 or 5 million job switches every month in the U.S. economy. Okay? So income, in some sense, is determined in the short run. Wealth is not. And we're interested in the correlates of who owns what. So in one of the slides this morning, do we care about Bill Gates or Bill Ford Jr.? How does that change over time? We could say something about that now. What about the long run? And then there was an argument, because I met Thomas after he wrote his first book that I don't think as yet has been translated into English, about income inequality in France. And in the book, if you take the time to read it in French, Thomas actually invents two different 19th centuries for France. And we thought that was a little unfair to France. And then we went to see him. Gilles Poselvin and I went to see him. And Thomas said, there's no data. So we went off as economic historians and brought him back some data and said, we can make more. So we've made more. And then the next question is exactly why and how does inequality fall between 1914 and 1945, which occurs in a large number of countries, but for different reasons in different places. So what we right now have is about 629,000 Parisians in our data set who happen to die in a year that is either number 2 or 7, starting in 1807. And the reason we can do this is, again, because of a political decision, which is during the French Revolution, they passed a law that said that everyone leaving an estate would have to pay a tax on the first franc. So there's no censoring. And actually, there's a typo in the slide. It's 1956, which means everybody who has an estate is covered. In the U.S., less than 2% or 3% of the population is liable for the tax. Since 2001, we've been collecting this information. It's a 20% sample of the whole. It's a complete sample of every given year, which is important if you want to catch the very rich who show up unexpectedly. And we know at least for every year and every person, at least growth, real, and movable estate. For 1872 and blah, 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 we went back after we started doing this and said, well, wait a second, we don't know what actually people own in more detail, who they are, and a whole bunch of stuff. So we invented a stratified sample that essentially starts with everyone in the top 2%, doubles the sampling size, so from 2 to 6, and halves the sampling rate, because the more people you have, they more look more and more the same. Now, the other thing, we made a decision about what it is that we're going to collect, and we decided to focus on Paris. Paris is not France, and I'll come back to this issue at the end, but it's useful because the rich are overrepresented. If you're interested in the evolution of wealth inequality, you want to capture the rich. Okay? And Paris matters its own right, because if you're interested in political economy issues, people who are influential tend to live in the capital. Although in the U.S., you might worry about also having New York and not just Washington, D.C. Certainly in the 19th century, Washington, D.C. was not particularly important. Okay, so Paris is rich. So the bottom line is Paris's share of the French population, and you notice that it never gets much past 6%. These are people who died. This is a share of all deaths. And you'll notice one of the things you do when you do history, bad things happen. So there's a blip in the third observation, which is actually a cholera epidemic. Okay? And then Paris's share in wealth, as you notice, grows to about over 25% of all the wealth in France left at death and has declined essentially since the beginning of the 20th century. And this is both because people outside of Paris have become wealthier and also because there are parts of wealthy people who would live in the capital happen not to live in the city because the western suburbs have become important. Second thing we're able to do is essentially give you the same kind of data that you saw, but we don't start in 1963 because somebody published the data. We went out and got it. So this is the distribution of wealth in Paris, and this is a familiar picture about who's at stake. So the black line is the top 1%, and you'll notice they never own less than half of all the wealth that's left behind in Paris. It peaks above 60% and then goes through a slow decline. Our data right now end in 1952. We are collecting 1957, and we'll get 1962. There are problems for the later on years because the archives don't all have all of the data. But you'll notice a lot of that growth and change comes at the expense of the next 9%. Until essentially 1900, the right way to think about it is anybody who's not in the top 10% didn't own anything. It's not quite right, but as a first approximation. One of the interesting things is this is a period of rapid economic growth in Europe, in France, and people overwhelmingly die with nothing. So there is an issue that if you're thinking about patrimonial wealth is, are you desiring to transmit? Okay, and there are fiscal issues associated with that. And then you can see that right around 1917, you see this growth in the share of the middle 40%, and that is actually not associated with redistribution, associated with forced savings programs put in the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s that diffused to more and more of the population. Second part is, again, these are things that you can do in some places and not everywhere else. It turns out for people who are married in France, when they die, they have to dissolve the marriage. And the way the French set up taxes and marriage, the marriage is a partnership, and the wealth that you inherit is your investment in that parent's has to be returned to you before the partnership is dissolved. So we observe not only the wealth of the person who died, but the wealth that they inherited over the course of their lifetime. And that allows us to compute both inherited wealth and the wealth you leave behind. So we then define a group of individuals to be called rentiers, who are people who could have left behind what they left just simply by holding on to their inheritance and the capital income that came from that inheritance. Okay? So they could have enjoyed all of the income from their labor savings, from labor, saved nothing out of labor, right? So none of these IRAs, retirement plans that you have, right? None of that, and still left the estate that they left just by keeping on to the capital income. In fact, the right way to think about it is rentiers are consuming about two-thirds of the capital income or more. Actually, all inheritors consume over two-thirds of the capital income that they get. They don't save very much out of capital income. They just don't save very much in before World War I. And then the share of rentier in wealth is well about over 60%. Now, that also means that there's also a society which is very stable in certain ways and has a lot of turnover, right? Because 40% of that wealth is accumulated by non-rentier. People have to save out of labor income, okay? Now, the other thing that's important, and I won't show you that slide, is in the top 1%, there are almost nobody who did not inherit something. There's a substantial fraction of non-rentier, people who actually to save out of labor income, made their wealth, but very few people started with nothing, okay? When you go further down, there are more and more people who started nothing and accumulated some wealth, okay? Now, somebody asked earlier, is inequality bad or good? So the first thing to notice is to get this redistribution, this decline in inequality here, is associated with a massive decline in average wealth. The average world wealth of Parisians in 1947 is the same as in 1807. World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II erased over a century of wealth accumulation. Do you want to do that to reduce wealth inequality by 9%? Probably not. We better find more subtle instruments for policy. The interwar period, or the wars period, is not a good place for us to go back to take inspiration, because a lot of what's going on is massive, massive wealth destruction, at least if you believe the stories for Paris. Okay, on the other hand, not all bad. So here are the average age at death, and this is actually, you can also look at mortality data. If you're more of a demographer, average weight of death is a strange notion, but this will work. So the top line is the top 0.1%, and you'll notice that even in 1807, they die around age 60, and over time, their age at death is growing. So essentially, the very wealthy are dying older and older. And one of the things that we've been working on, and we've been working on a variety of different ways of trying to figure out, whether the wealthy die old, because being wealthy is good. You can afford servants. You can afford a larger house to isolate yourself from other people who are sick. Or simply, once you become wealthy enough, you just can't spend enough money. Because, by the way, if you're buying paintings, that's consumption, but those have value in the future. So you really want to think about consumption as really reducing your wealth. And so it could just be that if you die at 85 and you're sufficiently wealthy, you just die richer than if you died at 80, just simply because it's accumulation, passive accumulation is just happening. And you'll notice now that for the first half of the 19th century, the next group that I have on there, which is the 90th and 95th percentile, is very flat. They died about 55, substantially younger, and then they start to pick up. And then the bottom 70% are flat until about 1867, 1870. And then they start to pick up. So their life expectancy is starting to rise in the period where life inequality is the highest in Paris because of the diffusion of public infrastructure, sewers and clean water, among other things. So you can have high inequality with some forms of public wealth that mitigate its consequences for the broad population. Now, another work that I've done, not with Thomas, we actually argue that the inequality of Paris is associated with the way in which this infrastructure diffuses, because the rich don't want to subsidize the poor, and so it's adopted at much higher rates in rich neighborhoods. Essentially, user fees are high. So the rich are willing to pay the high user fees, adopt at an earlier rate, and that actually increases life expectancy inequality for a while. But over time, economic growth does trickle down, and everybody gets clean water and sewers. Okay? So the shocks. So I've talked about wealth destruction. There also are serious fiscal innovations. And if you have a micro data set, you can apply the fiscal system to your tax records and say, just how redistributive was this? Okay? And so you'll notice, and so the French system is complicated because it's not an estate tax, which is what we have in the U.S. It's an inheritance tax. It's paid by the people who receive the money, and it depends, the rate they pay depends on how much they get and who they are relative to the deceased. So children pay a relatively low tax rate because the idea is you have to be able to transmit to your children. But if you hand it over to charity, pay a high tax rate. French don't believe in charity. And if you leave it to some people who are not relatives, you essentially pay a high tax rate. So this very high point in 1927 is actually because one of the Stern families was one of the richest banking families in Paris. Both the wife and the brother die. The husband inherits both at very high rates of marginal taxation. Okay? But you'll notice the rates are much lower for other people. So there is real progressive taxation on estates. Problem, and that has a very small effect on total wealth inequality because, again, we tend to measure wealth inequality pre-tax, what you leave behind. And so it's only going to show up 30 years later when your children die. Okay? Again, these processes, long-run data sets are important if you really want to capture the impact of progressive taxation, which may explain why, even though wealth is being reconstituted in the 1950s and 60s, inequality, wealth inequality in France remains relatively low relative to the past. Okay? So the rate, the road ahead. So what I would argue is we could just sit back and watch how rapidly capital in the 21st century evolves. My guess is given globalization, it's going to evolve pretty fast. Or we can take a new set of richer questions where history and policy interact. So for instance, inequality is spatial, not just macroeconomic. So a lot of what we're talking about is the U.S. But San Diego and Fresno are not the same. New York and Los Angeles are not the same. But inequality is heavily an issue of big cities, and people are moving to these places. People are moving from equal environments to unequal environments within the United States. They're moving from Iowa and Nebraska to New York and Los Angeles and have been doing so for a long time. So we don't necessarily mind inequality so much in some cases. But we really need to get down to these spatial issues pretty seriously. Second issue is memory public wealth over the long term and the distribution of public expenditures. And one thing that's been very clear is we don't know quite how to attribute the public wealth to individuals, but a lot of the reasons why the consequences of this high, increasing inequality in the U.S. has been somewhat muted is because we do have a really large public infrastructure that we all benefit from. So when I went to graduate school at Caltech, there are mountains that are 8,000 feet right behind it. You couldn't see them because of pollution. You're poor or rich, you benefit from the air quality improvement. That's public wealth. Okay? And then we need to integrate human capital. Now, on the historical period, it doesn't matter very much, certainly for France, since the fraction of people who graduated from high school and at the beginning of World War I was less than 10%. But in understanding what's going on today, I think integrating human capital to our notions of wealth is going to be really important. It's an interesting methodological problem. And on that note, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean-Laurent. Emmanuel Saez.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here on this panel. So I'm going to talk about income and wealth inequality. I will say a few things about what we did, and then I will talk briefly about next step. So let me start with income inequality. So 15 years ago in 2000, Thomas Piketty visited MIT for the fall. So he was just done having completed his first huge book on French high incomes, where he had for 2 years. Okay, yeah, I'm going to use this one. So, yes, so Thomas Piketty visited MIT 15 years ago. He was just done having completed his monumental study of French top incomes. Okay, and so what he found there in this big book is that French income concentration had been very high, but had dropped during, you know, the first half of the 20th century and had stayed relatively low, so that the problem of income inequality was perhaps not such a big deal anymore. So that big book wasn't a bestseller, in part because it was an enormous book, you know, where half the book was taken by very long and detailed appendix tables. Nevertheless, the book ended up being extremely influential academically because it set the template about how you could use the tax data to look at inequality in a way, in a tradition that had been lost. And indeed, so when he was at MIT that fall, in 2000, we started using, you know, the same methodology and apply it to the United States, and we constructed a series of income concentration like this one that is displayed here that tells you, you know, what share of total income is a given income group. So here it's the top 10% getting. Okay, and so you can see that it has that big U-shape, and when at that time, you know, we ended the series here in 1988. So already by then, you know, it was apparent that it was a big U-shape. So from that, you could see that the big decline in inequality was totally concentrated, you know, in the few years of World War II, flat afterwards, and then a slow increase, you know, I mean, an increase that starts, you know, around 1980. So right there in that graph, you can see that it's not, you know, slow-moving technology trends. It's big events, you know, World War II. And then 1980, of course, in the U.S., you know, is the start of the Reagan revolution. Okay? So actually, this, I should mention, you know, that this work had been pioneered decades back, you know, 50 years earlier by Simon Kuznets, a famous economist, who actually first used those tax records to look at inequality in the U.S. And his end year was 1948, so he really had only that part. And so for him, you know, inequality was decreasing, so he had an optimistic view, you know, that the market economy would correct itself and that, you know, we shouldn't be worried about inequality. So at that time, you know, when we did those series, colleagues were interested in them, but for years the series didn't have much of an impact in the broader public. So why is that? I mean, go back, you know, to 2000. So that's the end of the second Clinton term. It was the Bush-Gore campaign, you know, so actually income concentration had increased enormously under, you know, Clinton's watch, but that's not something that would want to be discussed, you know, in the campaign. You know, Gore wouldn't boast about that. Bush certainly didn't want, you know, to emphasize that, given that his plan was to give the rich, you know, big tax cuts. So it actually took a few years, you know, of continuing producing that data, you know, a change in administration, a recession, and a slower economic growth for interest in those numbers to pick up. And that, what has struck me, you know, as we were updating these data year after year, is that the numbers that really had the biggest resonance or impact with the public were numbers like, hey, what fraction of economic growth is going to each group? So it's really the integration of the analysis of economic growth and income inequality. And it turns out that what we did here was really about inequality. Those numbers have been used but are not the right numbers really to think about integrating income inequality and economic growth, because for economic growth we measure those things, you know, with national accounting, the concept of national income that is really the sound economic concept to measure economic growth. Incomes reported on tax returns are only a fraction of national incomes. Many things that are economic incomes don't show up on tax return. So to do a proper analysis, joint analysis of inequality and growth, you need to do some work to really think about how you should distribute national income, or if you want, you know, scale up the reported incomes on tax returns so that they match national income. So that's the future of research, and that's what we are trying to do, you know, with Thomas and also younger co-authors of ours, you know, Gabriel Zucman. And so let me show you preliminary evidence that we've put together and will help understand the interest or the issues, you know, raised by the rise in income inequality in the United States. So what this graph shows you, you know, the black line here is the real income per adult in the U.S. economy from 1946 to 2012. And so that comes from national income. So you see there is economic growth. So in 1946, it's $20,000 on average. Today, or in 2012, it's $60,000. On average, it's a smooth growth. I mean, it's faster in the first period, you know, 2% per year up to 1980 on average, only 1.4% since then. But overall, it doesn't look like there is a dramatic change in economic growth. However, when you look at the incomes for the bottom 90%, and this time, you know, it's really pre-tax incomes, but they match. They line up, you know, two national income. That is, it's a really comprehensive, the sound definition of total income. You get the series in diamond here. So it's lower, you know, because it's the bottom 90%. So, but what is striking is that in the first decades, from 46 to 1980, it's the same rate of growth. That is, the economy is growing equitably. 2% extra per year on average, 2% extra per year for the bottom 90%. In contrast, since 1980, you really have a huge difference. On average, the growth is 1.4%. For the bottom 90%, it's 0.7%. So we've been reproached, you know, many times, we are only interested in top earners, okay? So that's a fair criticism, but right there you can see that top earners take such a big chunk of the total economic pie, and especially economic growth in a period of rising inequality, that they do really affect, you know, your overall view on economic success. So national accounts tell you, you know, 1.4% growth per year, which is not too bad, but if you exclude, you know, the top 10%, the vast majority, bottom 90%, you get only half that number. And you can see here as well that at the time we produced the series, you know, growth for the bottom 90% during the Clinton administrations with the economy booming had been going very well. So that's why the issue of inequality was less salient. But growth stalled afterwards. There was a collapse, I mean, a sharp drop in incomes of the bottom 90%, you know, since the Great Recession. And what is striking is that after the Great Recession ends, the bottom 90% is really flat. That is, there is really hardly any recovery for the bottom 90%, while on average, you can see the Great Recession and then a recovery of the Great Recession. So it's really inequality is really affecting, I mean, creating a huge disconnect between overall posted GDP numbers and the experience of the majority. So in the future, you know, we are continuing putting together those numbers. We're also going to produce after-tax and after-transfer series. That's something that was mentioned. We've been interested so far mostly in pre-tax income inequality, but obviously the government is huge. You know, the government takes 30 to 50% of total income and gives it back, you know, directly as programs or public goods. And of course, the distribution after tax, after transfers, is going to be substantially different. The government is able to soften a lot of those inequality trends, recession blows, etc., and that needs to be studied together, you know, with pre-tax income. Now, the other thing we did was to look at the composition of top incomes, because incomes can come from your work, labor income, or from the assets you own, you know, capital income. So here, to illustrate this, this series, you know, if you look at the top line here, it shows you the share of total income going, sorry, to the top 0.1% of the top 0.1% family. So it has this huge U-shaped pattern, right, that was evident before. There has been an enormous increase in income concentration in the United States. But what this chart also shows you is how those top incomes are divided between, you know, salaries here, business income, which is a mix of labor income and returns on asset, ordinary capital income, you know, think interest, dividends, etc., and realized capital gain. So again, when we first produced the series, we ended up in 1988. So it did look like salaries were increasing enormously. That is, the comeback of inequality was mostly a labor income phenomenon. That's the way we put it, and we contrasted that with the earlier period of income inequality, that is, before the Great Depression. There was a lot of inequality, but the top was mostly capital income. That is, people deriving very large income from just owning assets, while in the new era, it seemed to be mostly labor income. Now, 15 years later, you can see that the labor income component seems to have stalled, you know, and there has been really a dramatic surge of business income, ordinary capital income, and realized capital gains, so that today, just looking at that chart, you would say, look, it's both a labor and capital income a phenomenon. And indeed, Thomas' book is mostly about capital and wealth, okay, that is its distribution. And obviously, the book had a great success in the United States, in part because the trends in income inequality, as I've shown them to you, you know, were dramatic. That growth was stalling. That certainly had to be a big factor. But the other reason why the book, in my view, you know, struck a nerve with the American public is that Thomas Piketty was telling us that wealth inequality is going to make a comeback, and very high wealth concentration and the people at the top of the wealth distribution will likely overwhelmingly be inheritors. That is, people who didn't really work for their wealth but got it from their parents. And that really struck a nerve, you know, in the U.S. public, where we love to think about ourselves as a meritocratic society. So a big shift, you know, in the message, where, you know, when we first did that study, we were saying the working rich are making a comeback. Piketty is telling us the inheritors are going to dominate the distribution. So this is a critical question. Unfortunately, data on wealth distributions is not nearly as high quality as data on income distribution in the United States. And actually, in France has much better wealth data. And the great work he's been doing with Jean Laurent is an illustration of that. Nevertheless, in the United States recently, we've managed, you know, to leverage this very high quality income data to estimate wealth inequality by what's called, you know, capitalizing incomes. That is, from a given capital income, you can infer that the person has assets that generates that income. And so by multiplying the capital income by a multiplier, you know, you can recover the size of assets. So that's a methodology that is also, you know, very old, but that we've applied systematically recently with Gabriel Zucman. And so we get a picture of wealth inequality, you know, over a century in the United States, that also has this big U-shape picture, you know, with a big, very high levels of wealth concentration early on, the top 0.1% getting, you know, 20-25%, big drop, and then in the last decade, really a comeback of wealth inequality. And so the counterpart of that is that if you look at middle class wealth, is a mirror image in some sense. That is, you had a growing middle class wage over the first part of the 20th century with the development of home ownership pension, followed by an erosion since the 1980s of middle class wealth, mostly due to a surge in debt. Okay, that is, home ownership has stayed relatively high, but that homeownership, you know, doesn't have a lot of equity because mortgage debt has increased, student loans, consumer credit debt. So in terms of the theory, is R versus G explaining that? It's too early to say. But what is very clear in the United States is that the collapse of middle class savings rate has played a role in widening wealth inequality. So the second question about whether inheritors are making a comeback or not is something you cannot really answer. From that graph, we don't really know if those guys here having very lots of wealth are mostly self-made, so think about Bill Gates, or whether they are inheritors. What we suspect is that of these very large fortunes that are created, something is going to have to happen to them. Either they are transmitted, you know, to kids, family, or they are given to charities. So there, you know, don't be fooled, you know, by the Bill Gates example, or the, you know, where he's pledged, you know, to give all his fortune to his foundation and charity. That's not representative, because actually you can see very well the charitable giving data in the tax records, because you get a deduction for it, so it's very well reported. And the very wealthy give on average, you know, 10% perhaps of their estate. So it means that 90% is going to pass probably, you know, to the next generation. So it does look like the United States is on a path, indeed, you know, if nothing changes, to become a society, you know, where inheritors will dominate the top of the distribution, or be a significant fraction of the distribution. Thank you.
Of Thomas Piketty. Thomas, you can sit there or go sit there. It's fine. Great. Yeah. Wonderful. Is this mic on?
Yes, it seems to be on. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Peter, for organizing this. And I'm very moved to be there today with Emmanuel, Arthur, and Jean-Laurent. So I did not prepare any slide. I let you do the hard work and show us data Let me just take this opportunity. I think I'm going to be brief so that we have time for questions and discussion. Let me just take this opportunity to say again, you know, how grateful I am to Emmanuel, Art, and Jean-Laurent, and more generally, how much, you know, this book could never have been written without this large international cooperation and teams that we have put together. And, you know, I am the only one responsible for the mistakes that could be in the book, or, you know, the actual writing. You know, the book is an attempt to propose a consistent historical interpretation for the set of data. And so some of the interpretation is my own, and I don't want to take, you know, Jean-Laurent or Emmanuel, and certainly not Arthur, with me on this. But there is no way I could have written this and proposed this interpretation without this this collective research program. Also, there is no way I could have communicated my book to the world without the beautiful English language translation of Art. So, you know, you can see that my English sounds a lot like French, and you can imagine that my written English also looks a lot like French. And, you know, look, it's really good that we have different language in the world, and that we know a language in which we can write and think. And, you know, I think had I written the book directly in English, it would have been much less, nice book to read. And, you know, when I read my book in English today, you know, I cannot believe that I wrote this. You know, it's like so Arthur is more than a translator. I guess a translator is always more than a translator. But in this case, I must say, you know, I was sending my chapters to Arthur, and he would send me them back in English. And initially, I thought that it will take me a lot of time, you know, to be familiar with the English translation and to like it. But I did not change anything. I changed like one sentence per chapter, or, you know, one word. It was just perfect from the beginning. And again, from the beginning, I thought, well, this is better expressed, better written than I could ever have written it in English. And so, thanks, Art. You know, this is, I really want to pay a tribute to Art today and every time I can, because I think without such a high-quality translator, you know, the book probably would not have been so successful. And of course, the English language edition has been extremely important for the international success. Although I would like to remind my American friends and English-speaking friends that there are other languages in the world, you know, and strangely enough, and that although, you know, 650,000 copies is a lot in English, that's less than a third of the world sales. That's between one quarter and a third of the world sales, which are about 2.2 million. So, you know, the English language is, the share of US GDP is about 20-25%, and you know, the share in the sales is 25 to 30%, which is, of course, you know, it's a big part, but it means that there is 75% of the world that's reading in other language than English, and right now the sales in Chinese, Japanese, in Brazil are much bigger accumulated than the sales in English, so that's something I'm also very proud of, because I think the issue of inequality has become very important in the US, of course, but it's very important everywhere as well, with different national specificities and different national histories. So each country has its own intimate history with inequality and equality, and has to find its way, its compromise with some acceptable level of inequality. No country wants a complete equality, but every country has to find some ways to, you know, to make inequality acceptable and fair to its citizens. And the reading of the book in China or in Brazil or in South Africa or in France or in Germany is very different from that in the US. But the general common point in my experience in traveling around and talking about the book is that there is a very, you know, I guess the success of the book, generally speaking, comes from the fact that there are many people in the world who are tired to hear that this is too complicated for them, and that economic and financial issues should be left to a small group of experts who have built such sophisticated economic science that the rest of the world cannot understand. And of course, this is a big joke. There is no such economic science. We are in the social sciences. All we can do is, I think, to try to collect historical data as carefully as we can and propose consistent interpretation. But there are always different ways to interpret historical evidence. And in the end, the real objective is to allow readers and citizens and to make their own mind about these complicated issues. And we've had already inequality crises in the past. We've had already public debt crises in the past. In Europe, people are much more interested in the historical part on public debt than the part on inequality than the US. So people have different readings of the book in different parts of the world. But the common point is that, looking at this historical record can always, can offer alternatives. I guess the main lesson from history is that there are always alternatives. There are always different ways to deal with public debt, to deal with inequality. And the main enemy to me is intellectual nationalism, the view that each country is so special that you cannot learn from other countries' experience. And this is something that is sometimes very strong, of course, in the US, but it's also very strong in France, it's very strong in China. Every country seems believed to be exceptional. But I think looking at other countries' historical experience with inequality is extremely important to try to find better solutions and have a more quiet, more reasonable public discussion about inequality and taxation. So, of course, it's always very difficult to have a quiet discussion about taxation. People get excited very quickly, but at least trying to put this evidence on the table can help us. So I would like to thank really, Emmanuel and Jean-Laurent, without whom I could never have made progress on this research. So Emmanuel mentioned that we started working on the evolution of US inequality in the fall of 2000 when I was visiting MIT, and Emmanuel was a young assistant professor at Harvard. But in fact, it started even before, because when Emmanuel was a graduate student at MIT, he had started to work on the interwar historical data from the income tax for the US, which induced me partly to look at the French data also. So, this was without Emmanuel, who also did the historical work for many other countries, including Canada, Japan, Spain with Facundo Alvaredo, who also worked with Argentina. So, without Emmanuel, all this project would have probably remained, much smaller project. And so, Emmanuel made a huge difference. We've also done together a lot of more theoretical work on optimal redistribution, optimal taxation of income and wealth, and the book has been very, very strongly influenced by this joint work. Now, with Jean-Laurent Rosenthal and Gilles Postel-Vinet, we were able to work on even longer data for wealth. So with Emmanuel, we've worked mostly on income, although now we are moving toward working more on wealth. With Jean-Laurent and Gilles, we've been able to go back to the period of the French Revolution, because you have the French Revolution certainly did not create a perfect society, but at least it created an observatory for wealth. So you have wealth is registered at the time it is transmitted, starting with the French Revolution. So you can follow the evolution of wealth through the 19th century, 20th century, in a way that is not possible in most other countries. So in Britain, you have to wait until the very end of the 19th century to see something like a unified system of taxation of wealth at the time of transmission. In the US, it's only in 1916 that a federal estate tax is created, and it's only for the top 1 or 2% of the distribution, so you cannot really follow the wealth of the entire population, and this is why it is so difficult to work on the history of wealth distribution in the US. So for France, we were able to return to the archives back to the time of the French Revolution, and there is no way I could have done this without meeting Jean-Laurent and Gilles, who had been working on this historical material that is a very technical archive. It's all paper handwritten. Handwritten material that you have to get on the computer. This requires a very deep institutional knowledge of how this was produced by the state administration, and this kind of work would never have been possible without Jean-Laurent and Gilles. Now, this is continuing. This is a process. I guess, to me, one of the most interesting impact of the publication of the book is that data is now available for even more countries. So in particular, there is a number. There are many limitations of the book. One of the big limitations is that emerging countries, developing countries, are not as present as they should. Now, this is not entirely my fault. This is not that I was not interested. It's because the data very often was not available. Now, one of the positive impacts of the publication of the book is that there are now more governments who are letting us access their fiscal data and fiscal archives than used to be the case. So in countries like Korea or Taiwan or Brazil or Argentina or Mexico, we are now able to access the historical fiscal files which we were not able to access before. And we are putting new data online almost every week, or at least every month. We have new data updates, new countries, in particular thanks to Facundo Alvaredo, Gabriel Zucman, and Tony Atkinson, who is, in a way, together with Simon Kuznets, the godfather of all historical work on inequality. Kuznets published his great book in 1953, which was the first historical study on inequality. But then Tony Atkinson published in 1978 what is probably the equivalent of Kuznets 1953, but for the study of the historical evolution of wealth in Britain. So he didn't return to the individual level archives that Jean-Laurent and Gilles have been working with, but he used historical published tabulations from the UK estate tax, and he did a very, very careful work, and that's really the equivalent of Kuznets for wealth. And so Tony has been extremely active also in this program, has played a fantastic role. Let me stop there. Maybe just one very simple point. There was one point which was raised in the discussion this morning, which I thought was very interesting, is, is it possible to live with extreme inequality, extreme concentration of wealth, and what can we learn from the experience in such societies? And so there was this comparison that was made with pre-World War I France in the data that Jean-Laurent was showing, and how public infrastructure can be a way to mitigate also extreme inequality in private wealth and private property. And I thought this was really very, very interesting and important. Let me say, I think it's this kind of comparison across societies are very important. Some of the reactions to this finding on pre-World War I France or Europe in this country, in the US, was, this is ancient history. We don't care about these. These were, you know, agrarian societies with rentiers, with no innovation, whereas today we are a society with so much innovation that this is going to solve all inequality problems. So let me simply say that around 1900, 1910, you know, these are not agrarian societies. You know, these are societies where, you know, in France or in Britain, where we have, you know, small inventions like the automobile, the electricity, the radio, the transatlantic, you know. So, of course, this is less important than Facebook today, but still, you know, these are... significant innovations. And at the same time, so you have all this innovation, all this economic growth, and you have at the same time extreme inequality, extreme concentration, perpetuation of wealth. So was it possible to live with it? Well, yeah, it was possible in the sense you still had innovation, you still had some mobility, you know, a lot of the new people at the top were new, but with extreme concentration and extreme perpetuation. So also you have mobility. You know, if you just count on charitable giving, as Emmanuel was saying, to solve the problem of perpetuation across generation of this wealth creation, probably that's not going to work. You know, there's just one number I would like to mention, you know, which I think illustrates, you know, the relative importance of the different effect and the fact that, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy about how charitable giving is going to solve all the problem. You know, if you take the endowment of a university like Harvard over the past 30 years, the annual, you know, gift that were made to the Harvard endowment by former students or whoever gives money to Harvard is equivalent to about 0.5% of the endowment each year. Now, the financial return to the endowment has been over 8% per year in real terms, above inflation. So if you want to explain the evolution of Harvard endowment, you know, which used to be a couple of billion dollars and which is now $40 billion, the gifts are completely irrelevant. You know, well, they are, you know, 0.5% each year on the endowment as compared to 8% return. It's not completely zero, but it's really a very small part as compared to the rate of return that was obtained. So, you know, this charitable giving, you know, this can be very useful sometimes to get your children admitted to Harvard or whatever. But, you know, if you want to understand the real importance of how the endowment has been changing, this is really quantitatively not significant. So I think it's important, you know, all these claims that are made about charitable giving or the claims that are made about meritocracy and who gets admitted in top universities. And the data that Emmanuel and Raj Shetty have been collecting about this recently is fantastic. I hope I had it when I wrote my book, but it was not available at that time, so I was not able to use it. But, you know, all these claims that are made about charitable giving or about meritocracy, you know, very often are very strong self-serving claims that are made by the winners of the system. And, you know, there's a lot of imagination in the winners of the system to justify the existing inequality. Now, these claims sometimes are partly true. Of course, these claims are never completely wrong. Otherwise, it would be easy to see it. But sometimes they are wrong to a large extent. So I think it's important to put these claims under public scrutiny, to try to put data on them, to put numbers, accessing data on the income of parents of Harvard University students or Stanford University students is sometimes very difficult. And Emmanuel has a lot to say about this, if you ask him. But I think it's important, you know, that we put these things under public scrutiny so that we finally you know, contribute to a more informed democratic discussion and possibly to political change. So let me stop there. I've already been far too long, and I hope we have time for questions.
Thank you, Thomas. So I'd like to open it up for questions, and I'd like to follow the rule very strictly of the microphones. I will take turns. I will not call on people who don't come to the microphone, but if you have a question, please come to the microphone. And there's a gentleman over in that microphone over there, so why don't you start, and please make it a question and not a speech, because that way everybody will have more time. Please.
I have a question about the data in that this case, the data and the social impact. The difference between the gains to those who occupy that area under the graph for capital income versus capital gains. You know, gains flash upwards. you know, during times of great expansion and innovation and so on. And I suspect that if that data were disaggregated down to the individual level, we'd find a collection of individuals, you know, who earned that money, you know, and the vast majority of those of the people in the income category are probably rentiers or kind of hybrids of a bit of innovation and a lot of rentiers. The reason for focusing on this is my speculation about the social effects. Obviously, a population of rich composed strictly of rentiers is going to have a different social impact than the impact of a population filled with Bill Gateses and even David Kochs. And so, you know, as we go forward into the next session, thinking about long-term effects of inequality and measures to reduce inequality, you know, whether the question of these relative differences, the pros and cons of policies that reduce one kind of capital wealth versus another, you know, income versus gains, you know, might be worth considering, you know, in the institutional, you know, and policy perspective, you know, the way we set these things up, the way we think about them, the way we incentivize, say, innovators. Maybe there's an argument that innovators don't need to make billions. They're going to do what they're going to do anyway, whereas rentiers want to be assured of a certain amount of minimum income from their assets in order to maintain their lifestyle.
Thank you. John, who wants to jump in that one? Who wants to go?
It's Emmanuel's data.
Emmanuel, you go.
Now, this is a good question. And you know, moving forward, we'd like in the United States, you know, to do more to understand exactly who are the people in recent years where we have a lot of better data, you know, which industrial sectors are they from? Did they made their wealth, you know, or did they receive significant inheritances? And so, unfortunately, we won't be able to go back, like Thomas and Jean-Laurent, you know, a very long time, but at least for the recent period, and that's interesting, you know, we'll be able to let you know more, because it's true, in the end, you know, whether inequality, how the public is going to judge inequality will depend a little bit on do we think that the people who are getting those income are really contributing, you know, to society. So in principle, in a well-functioning market economy, your contribution is exactly the income you make. Unfortunately, you know, there are significant departures from that happy model. And by drilling into the data, you know, there are some financial activities, you know, so some of them like, you know, high-frequency trading by hedge funds, it's pretty clear to everybody that that doesn't really add any value. Others, you know, I mean, people like to cite Bill Gates. Certainly, you know, Microsoft was useful, but then it became a monopoly, you know, living on its rents and not innovating that much. So, you know, it is something that we want to dig into, and that's a very important question.
You should be very careful about sort of fiscal interventions to tilt those figures, because, as you know, certain sets of financial actors can declare their entire income as capital gains. This is called the carried interest deduction, right? So we want to be careful with this. And also, remember, real estate capital gains, which I think for people living in San Diego at times have been an important form of wealth accumulation, we're going to show up in there. So it's not just startup people who have realized an IPO. It's a much more complicated. The final thing is, you should be very careful to think that rentiers are conservative. Rentiers are going to have a very diversified portfolio, which could be very high risk. Remember, one of the classic forms of rentiers of the 1980s were the people who were called the Lloyd's names. They were partners in insuring very high-risk ventures who were using these things, and the collateral for this was their estates. So I wouldn't want to go to sort of making that. That's something we need to find out. I think we have a lot of prejudices and assumptions that we make about the forms of wealth that people have on the basis of their career. It's not to say that there aren't entrepreneurs that get a lot of wealth through capital gains, but I think these worlds are much more heterogeneous than we may have thought. And I think part of the problem, as Thomas said, is more data may allow us to see this more clearly and stop ascribing all of agriculture to a 160-acre farm held by a family instead of large agribusiness corporations in the U.S. So we want to actually go back and say, who are these things?
Great. And this microphone right here. Speak up to the mic, close to the microphone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I have one very quick question and then a more substantive one. The quick question is, did Goldhammer's beautiful translation ever tempt you to change the French original? And the more substantive question is, what kind of response are you getting from multilateral agencies? What kinds of roles do you see them playing? Are they going to play in response to what you have raised as questions?
To be honest, many of the other translations I have done tempted me to change the French, and in fact, it was necessary in order to get other French writers into English to do more violence to their sentences than in Thomas's case. He writes very clearly. He wrote the book with a broad reading audience in mind, and has spent time in the United States, so even though he thinks his English sounds like French, I think he's absorbed subconsciously some of the rhythms of the English language. So it was a relatively easy book to get into English. In a way, the irony is that it's the book for which I'm now best known, but it was by no means the most difficult translation I ever did. So.
You want to answer the other one?
So on the role of multilateral agencies, and what do I, you know, today, you know, the IMF, the OECD, you know, they all claim to be very concerned with inequality and financial transparency, and you know, I find this very interesting, but you know, in some way, very amusing, because I'm not too, you know, too convinced that they have really changed so much their view of the world. For many decades, they have played a very important role against redistribution, against fiscal progressivity, basically telling the rest of the world that a good fiscal system involves only a flat tax, a flat consumption tax. And so you have people within this institution, in particular in the research department at IMF, who might have a different view, or people, some people in subsection of the OECD, but by and large, these institutions are still, you know, very conservative about these issues. And you know, if you think of their concrete action, what was happening between IMF and Greece before the summer, you know, one of the key issues was that the IMF really wanted just a big increase in the value-added tax, so in the flat consumption tax, and the Greek government wanted to introduce little bit of an increase in the tax on corporate profits, and this was the issue on which the IMF said, no, we only want the increase in the value-added tax. And their view on financial transparency and transmission of information about cross-border financial assets is still very, very conservative. And recently, the agreement that was put together by the OECD regarding corporate taxation, you know, I think it's not really changing anything, and it's the biggest problem is it's not doing any harm either, but it's not really changing anything. And I think what's really harmful is that some of these institutions, you know, are claiming that they have changed, that they have solved the problem. And, you know, the problem is that this has been many times, you know, the OECD has claimed 20 times over the past decades that they have, that tax havens are over and we have solved the problem. And I think this is bad, you know, to claim that when the problem is not solved. It could be solved. You know, it's a political problem. It's not a technical problem. Let me just mention a very beautiful book by Gabriel Zucman called The Hidden Wealth of Nations that was just published in the U.S., which is showing that there are practical solutions, including a registry for financial assets, which is something that has been privatized, that has been done by private financial corporations, but which could be under public control, in particular through the U.S. And European Union governments. So there are solutions, but the multilateral agencies so far, you know, have been pretending to solve the problem more than addressing it really.
Thank you.
There.
Just thank you for a wonderful presentation, and I know coming to San Diego is a hardship for all of you. I'd like to thank you as a member of the audience. The people who say that we don't need to care that much about income inequality, or the people who explain why Americans don't seem to care much about it, often point to the increases in well-being among the very poor in this country and around the world. For example, compared to the 1960s, we have air conditioning now. Our residences are much bigger. Most of us have cars. Poor people have televisions and smartphones and better health care. So I wonder now that Angus Deaton has won the Nobel Prize, should we be looking a lot harder as an economics profession at consumption? Is that really the best way to measure whether inequality should matter?
Yeah, you know, of course, there's been some progress. There's been some economic and social progress, including in the U.S. in recent decades. But I think we could do even better. So, you know, we could have an even bigger increase in the well-being of the bottom 50%, you know, the health care of the bottom 50% in the U.S. You know, of course, it's better than 50 years ago, but it could be a lot better. And, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence across the world that it's possible to do better and that there's no need to have this extreme inequality at the top to do better. So I think above a certain level, inequality is just not useful for society, and in particular not useful for the bottom 50% of society. So as far as I am concerned, I am much more interested in the, you know, the absolute level of the bottom 50% than the top in itself. And I think there's no disagreement about this. Everybody cares more about the bottom 50%. The only interesting question is what is the level of the gap that with the top that can be justified by invoking the interest of the bottom 50%. And as I was saying before, you know, the elite groups, the winners, you know, of course, they always... You know, what's interesting is that they never try to say, well, okay, I'm rich, they're poor, you know, too bad for them. They're always trying to say, well, yes, I'm rich, but this is good for the poor. This is in their interest. And, you know, sometimes this is right, and sometimes this is wrong. And sometimes, you know, the self-serving statements go too far. And so we have to put them under public scrutiny so as to know when they go too far. And I think, again, in the U.S. in recent decades, I think these statements have gone too far in the sense that the huge increase in the top 1% share that Emmanuel was showing, you know, if we've had a growth rate of 5% per year, then why not? You know, if you grow at 5% per year and 2/3 of the growth goes to the top 1 or top 10, after all, why not? Although 2/3 would still be a lot. But, you know, if it was 5% per year growth, that would be sort of acceptable. But the growth rate has been 1.4%. So if you have 1.4% and 2/3 of it goes to the top, then it's not clear whether it's a good deal for the rest of the population. Well, I think it's clear it's not a good deal for the rest of the population. So it's, you know... We could do better for the bottom.
But measuring consumption in a way is the question.
So consumption.
All of you think about that.
So on consumption, yeah, of course, for the bottom groups, I think consumption is the right indicator. You know, it's almost equal to income because the bottom groups don't save very much. So when we look at income for the bottom 50%, it's almost consumption. And so that's a relevant thing to look. Also, accessing property and being able to have some property is also important. Now, at the very top, you know, consumption... I don't think this is a really good indicator of economic power and economic influence. So, you know, I had this discussion with Bill Gates when he called me and he wanted to write a review of my book. And basically what he said was, he told me, I love your book, inequality is a big problem, but I don't want to pay more tax, basically. And so his point was a bit more subtle. You know, he was saying, I'm ready to have a very progressive taxation if it's progressive taxation of consumption. So, you know, if I consume a lot, then you can have 90% tax on my very high consumption. Now, you know, the problem is, you know, when you have many billions dollars, you know, you cannot consume a big fraction of that just on your food and clothes. So what you're going to do is, you know, you're going to consume influence, you're going to consume politicians, you're going to consume journalists, you're going to consume academics, you're going to, you know, that. So, you know, what I ask Bill Gates is, how do you treat, you know, in his view, what he's doing with his money is the most useful thing he could do. And, you know, but so if I ask him, you know, what about the Koch brothers who are spending a lot of their money, you know, in the Tea Party movement or extreme fraction of the Republican Party, should this be counted as part of their consumption? And, you know, what was interesting in his answer is that, in fact, he was trying to defend the Koch brothers and basically saying, well, you know, one of them is not so nice, but the other one is not so bad. You know, I don't remember which one, so don't quote me on that. But basically, you know, I was struck by the sense of billionaire solidarity that I could hear. And basically, he didn't want someone to decide, instead of the billionaire, what was the useful charitable giving or, you know, influence spending. And, you know, the problem, you know, I have some sympathy for Bill Gates and this kind of view. You know, I can see why he prefers to decide where to put his money. But the problem is that it's difficult to organize a society with thousands of people, you know, who decide for themselves how much they want to contribute to the public good and what kind of education or health spending they want to finance. And, you know, I think the ability of billionaires to organize an education system and an health system for an entire country remains to be demonstrated. And in history, you know, well-functioning education and health system have been organized by and large by government and public administration, and this is how increasing literacy and life expectancy has occurred. So let's be, you know, very skeptical about this kind of statements.
Great. On this microphone here, Nick Binkley. I happen to know this gentleman.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I would like to consume a politician too, but I can't afford it. My question is jogged by Jean-Laurent's comment about entrepreneurialism and perhaps a concentration of wealth that has occurred over the last 40 years in that group of individuals, who many of them are in that 0.1%. And when I looked at Emmanuel Say's data, the top 10% pre-tax for the last 100 years has grown from 35% to 50% since 1980. And the top 1%, 0.1% pre-tax income has grown during that same period of time from 10% to 25%. And my question is there a correlation between income inequality in this country and the tripling of the growth or percentage of the GDP and the income of the entire country by the financial services sector?
Yes, yeah, so this is a very good question. It goes back, so who are those top incomes? We don't know yet very well, but my suspicion is that the financial sector plays a big role. I wouldn't be surprised if it explained, you know, almost half of the increase, you know, in those top incomes. Stay tuned. Hopefully we'll have good numbers, you know, for you in the not-too-distant future.
Can I climb on the back of Nick's question, because it's actually kind of an interesting methodological or an explanatory point for me, because your data has been really fascinating by looking at taxation. I mean, I think it was this morning you gave the slide that showed and one line was the marginal tax rate up in 90%, and then down here was pay, and then the tax rate went down and the pay skyrocketed. So in Nick's way, he asked that a simple mechanism of that is, given the possibility that you could keep the money, then motivates them to start earning, you know, manipulating the thing gigantically. But the way Nick phrased it, he refers to quite a lot of other regulatory and policy things that are not going to appear if you're just tracking taxes. So the challenge, I think, explanatorily, since your life is already complicated enough just trying to track down the data that you're doing, is when you wander into explanation, all this other regulatory domain is a big player in what it is, and then what incentivizes corporate managers to start paying themselves in capital gain. Well, partially that is, and the deferred, the carried interest thing, all that you're doing, there's a bunch of laws there that have to do with taxation, but then there's a whole lot of regulatory issues that aren't going to appear that way. And so, I mean, I guess I have a, I guess my question, kind of explanatory, is what do you do about that? Because, I mean, you're calling for an interdisciplinary approach. Yes, you do need that. But one of them is that the number of people it's going to take to then track down these other things in addition to the data that you're doing is required, going to require kind of a coordinated effort. If finance, I guess what I'm saying is, my question is, if finance really is as important as you're smelling, and you want to give an explanation of that, my question would be, would an explanation of that not require that you look at all the issues that my progressive banker friend here was just asking you to look at?
Yeah, no, I mean, Peter is right. That is, to understand finance, you know, you need to have the perspective of the people who know, you know, the field. Same thing, you know, for market power, antitrust, etc. Those fields typically have done their studies without thinking hard, what does it do to inequality? And really, we need to integrate that. That is, we need to bring that knowledge, you know, to bear and to be able to tell us, here is how much it explains, you know, of the charts you're seeing.
But Peter, at some level, this is a historical question, because the first thing Emmanuel wants to do is find out what's the representation of people in finance in that top income group, and what's their wealth accumulation if you do the capitalization for them. And I know I asked them the question, and the answer is yes, they have age. So you can look at people at different ages. But then if you want to say, when did the carried interest clause or a methodology diffuse and how important that is, it's probably not very important. There's probably no one piece of regulation that drives this thing. Right? So we do know from Thomas Philippon's data that the size of the financial sector is very related to deregulation. We do know that. And we want to be careful, because I think that was one of the things that was important that was said this morning, is that there's a, these really big changes in inequality are driven by a variety of different factors, that some of which occurred at a certain point in time and only realized later. For example, if you're really changing the way you're compensating people with stock options, but they only exercise the stock options a long time later, you may only see them in the wealth data at a certain point in time. You may see them in income data at a different time. So we want to be really careful about what it is that we want to know. And to go back to the issue on consumption, there isn't a single answer to the question of how unequal a society is. There's an answer to, given what I'm interested in understanding as a social outcome, there's a proper measure of inequality for that. And that's what we should be doing, instead of, you know, debating over the 1% or 5%, whether it's income after tax or before taxes. There are some questions where getting the after tax data is going to be really important. There are questions not so important. And as the first pass to describe that U shape that Emmanuel showed you, doesn't matter very much.
Way over there.
Brent hinted at this earlier, but I think a big, or I've seen a response to this book, that a lot of the inequality that's been generated is because of real estate and the rise of urban real estate as part of a way of building American wealth. And the consequences of this, I've seen different studies show interesting things, like a California legislative report that blamed zoning on, or blamed a big chunk of California's poverty on zoning, or how lost my train of thought, sorry. but anyway, would you advocate for public policy at the local level to reduce inequality, and how much of a factor do you think that is?
Okay, I don't know much about the recent debates on zoning in California, but generally speaking, I think you're perfectly right that all these issues about housing regulation, housing prices are very important for the evolution that we are talking about. So you know, I know more about the evolutions in Europe, and certainly in Europe, you know, the huge increase in housing prices in recent decades explain an enormous part, and in some countries even, you know, more than 100% of the evolution of aggregate wealth to income ratio in recent decades. And this has enormous consequences in terms of inequality and access to property. So, you know, this means that for the new generation who don't have any family wealth, accessing urban property in large cities just with your labor income is almost impossible, except if you have very, very high up labor income. But for you know, most people, including people who are quite high, this is impossible. So here it calls for different policies in terms of construction permits, zoning, some forms of rent control in Germany have been more successful than others in keeping rent at reasonable levels. So yes, that's definitely part of the. So we, you know, taxation is one policy tool, but you know, it has to be viewed as complementary with many other policy tools, you know, including corporate governance, financial regulation, housing regulation. That's really a multidimensional toolbox that we need to think about.
I remember the other thing I was going to cite. An increase in economic growth been lost because of zoning, blaming a lack of people being able to access the high incomes of urban areas.
Sorry, I didn't get it.
Because people don't have access to the higher incomes of being in urban areas that have these high housing prices, that this growth hasn't occurred in the economy, especially for people towards the bottom.
No, you're right. In some cases, that's really what's happening. Yes.
Add this microphone here. Thank you.
I was struck by the similarity between some of these curves and the CO2 emissions curves, and also the population curves. And as our population doubles in the world, I'm imagining that there is more income disparity, especially around the world, even than in Western countries. And also the fact that the average IQ is 100, which means that half the population will have IQs under 100, which means that they're suited for jobs that mainly don't exist anymore, and also unlikely to accumulate capital, as in these other graphs. So I just wondered how all this fits together and seems to make for a rather pessimistic picture.
That's a complicated question. I'm probably
sold all the books. Yeah.
I'm probably more optimistic than you are about, you know, the possibility to raise the capability and ability of different IQ groups, but. Leaving this aside, regarding the link between demographic growth, population growth, and the inequality, I think it's a very important but complex relationship because, you know, you don't want, very large population growth can make it difficult for some countries to invest in the proper public infrastructure, this creates lots of environmental problems, global warming, etc. On the other hand, the kind of negative population growth that we have in Germany or Japan or a number of European countries and also in Asia can create even bigger problems. And, you know, in terms of inequality, in particular, one of the conclusions of my work is that this can, you know, maybe inheritance and the power of inherited wealth in Germany or Japan or China in 2030 will be even more than in France at the time of Balzac, because with the decline of population, you know, it means, you know, the extreme case where you have a last generation, you know, of Germans or Japanese, you know, who don't have any children anymore, and then the last generation is going to inherit from the entire wealth that has been accumulated for the previous century. So the flow of inheritance will. So even not taking this extreme case, you know, when the size of the current generation who is born in Germany or Japan or China right now is 30% or 40% smaller than the size of the generation of their parents, which is what we have right now, this creates quite extreme consequences in terms of inequality. So I think, you know, you have to get it right. I think a small positive population growth is better than negative. And you know, one of the main historical strengths of the U.S. historically, of course, has been sustained population growth. And you know, I think the life will be very different in terms of inequality and tolerance to inequality if at some point the population starts to stabilize and population growth is not there anymore.
Okay, and that microphone there.
Yes, just a quick question. This is based on real data, of course, and to the extent that we estimate the monies that are offshore, some middle of the market might be $25 trillion. Would that inflate these numbers significantly? Because that's a pretty big number. It's also making money at whatever percent, 8%, 10%, and not paying taxes. Significant. It's a significant number because we can't measure it. You know, as an economist, you want real numbers, but there is these dark pools of money. So I was wondering your input on that. How would it affect this chart? Would it be significant or not?
Yeah, no, so this is a very good question. So it's hard to measure, but we are trying. And in particular, our young colleague, Gabriel Zucman, has just written a book, you know, that Thomas was recommending, you know, The Hidden Wealth of Nations, that tries, you know, to bring together the data we have to speak to that issue. How much money is abroad, you know, from U.S. residents or European residents? How much governments lose in taxes? Is it significant relative, you know, to total wealth? So in the case of the United States, it would make the increase in income concentration look slightly larger. Only slightly, because even though, you know, offshore tax evasion has increased, it's easier now, you know, to put money, to hide money abroad. For the U.S. economy, it's not yet very large. So it would worsen the trend a little bit. But for some countries in Europe, where they are more, wealthy Europeans are more aggressive to some extent, you know, than U.S. ones, you know, to hide their money, the effect would be larger. And then the book describes, you know, what are the policy options. And the Obama administration actually has taken a step, you know, with the so-called FATCA regulations to try to crack down, you know, on countries like Switzerland, which don't want to share, you know, information about U.S. accounts their banks might have. But it's a big issue.
Progress in Switzerland, but they give two-year warnings, say, to move your money out of Cayman Islands. So you really can't capture that money. It's always moving.
Yes, no. So that's why, yes, the solution has to be global. You can't crack down on only one tax haven, because then the money moves. But look, the way we make progress on this question is by flagging, you know, that this is a significant issue, and we hope, you know, the book of Gabriel will help on that front. But we need also people like you, you know, who raise the issue.
And this mic right here.
So do you think that the emergence of internet economy or e-commerce is going to be a transformative force against the trend of increasing equality? Because it makes more ordinary people easier to start a business or raise funds. Yeah, how do you think of that?
Well, you know, when I was an assistant professor, there was this company that got started called Amazon. And at the time, people thought about e-commerce as an extremely distributed business. That's not what's happened. The rents are accruing to a relatively small number of platforms that people visit and which are providing both ease of access and reliability. So it's not at all clear, you know, that this improvement in the technology is reducing inequality. What you have to think about is it is allowing a large number of small businesses to coexist, but their profits are probably pretty low. And a lot of the returns are going to the platforms that they have to pay to sell their stuff. They also have to pay the credit card. I mean, there's a whole bunch of big companies that are benefiting from this in really serious ways. So it creates a certain form of enterprise. But remember, a lot of these small businesses actually lose money if you count the value of time that the entrepreneur puts in. So I wonder about whether this actually is a great idea. But it certainly isn't the case that the internet is an egalitarian system. It is equally inegalitarian as any other brick and mortar industry.
I'd like to ask each of the panelists if they can give us an insight as to what we can look forward to, say, in the next year from each of them in their publications.
Well, I have actually retired from translating, and I'm working on two books. One is a novel about physics, which was my first intellectual passion. It's a historical novel which begins in 1934. And I'm working on another book, comparison of French and American democracy, which grows out of my longstanding interest in Tocqueville and my translations of Tocqueville. Whether you'll see either of those in the next year, I don't know yet.
So with two co-authors, one of whom I work with Thomas Gilbert-Salvinet and Philip Hoffman, who's a colleague of mine at Caltech, I'm finishing a book on sort of the structure of mortgage markets before banks. So for a really long time in the United States, for example, until the 1930s, most mortgages were held by individuals. So if you wanted to get a mortgage, most likely you went to find somebody else who would lend you the money. It took a very, very long time after the rise of financial institutions before the mortgage market was dominated by financial institutions. So we're interested in what happened before. And again, France is an unusually good place to collect data about transactions because the governments, in particular in the past, had a relatively light hand but liked to tax everything, which means there's a record of lots of transactions. So I'm working on that. And then after that, the major focus is going to be on, as this data set that I've been collecting with Thomas and Gilles is completed, to write a book on inequality in Paris from a variety of different perspectives, including the public health side, to try to make the case that the national aggregates are really important, but there are other ways in which these issues of distribution really matter.
Yeah, so let me just mention, as Thomas kind of already indicated, you know, and Arlette also discussed it, I'm also very interested in intergenerational mobility, that is, how people do based on how their parents were doing. So we are continuing work on that to look at the role of higher education. And the way we're going to start is to have a systematic database that tells you, you know, for UCSD, that's the composition, that's where the parental backgrounds, you know, that many come from the top 1%, that many from the top 10%, that many from the bottom 50%. And then the kids who were in UCSD, say, 10 years ago, that many, you know, are in the top 1% of their cohort, etc. Because, you know, as was discussed in the earlier panel, access to higher education, particularly, you know, the elite schools, plays a very big role, and besides, you know, transmission of wealth, there is also transmission of ability, you know, to navigate the education system. So having that data together, I hope, will foster, you know, a public debate on that issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I don't have another big book to ask Arthur to translate, but I hope this will come at some point. Now, in the coming months, we are extending our world top income database into a world wealth and income database where we, you know, the difference that we will put data online on wealth and not only on income. And also another important difference is that we are trying to extend to many more emerging countries. So, you know, in Latin America, in Brazil, in Asia, in Africa. So we have been working in particular with Facundo Alvaredo and other co-authors exploiting the historical data from the colonial time and comparing with inequality today, you know, in a number of, French and British colonies, also with Tony Atkinson. So it's very interesting because, you know, colonial inequality is a sort of extreme form of inequality that is difficult to justify on a meritocratic basis, of course, because the top is basically made of the colonial settlers and the bottom is made of the local people. Now, it's interesting to compare it to inequality today because, you know, some people would expect it was a lot higher. Well, maybe not. Some people would expect, you know, in terms of structure of labor income versus capital income, it should be very different. Well, maybe not. Or maybe yes, in some cases, you know, it's true for South Africa, it's true for Algeria or Cameroon. So that's, you know, extending outside OECD countries and rich countries is something I'm very interested in at, now.
I should add that the last book I translated before retiring was a book on the economics of the media by Julia Cagé, who happens to be Madame Thomas Piketty. So that is forthcoming, something you can all look forward to.
And she is speaking right now up at the faculty club. I have to bring the session to an end. I was very thrilled. I'm absolutely delighted. This was the kind of meeting I was hoping it would be. Thank you very much to the panel. Thank you very much for doing this. And thank you to the audience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.